WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. 7 years ago, Ty Cobb was a partner in a big international law firm, prominent, well-connected. Then he got a phone call. Would he give up his job to go work for the White House for a while? The client was Donald Trump, and the issue was Russian interference in the 2016 election. Trump and many others were being investigated in a probe headed by Robert Mueller, the former FBI director. In the end, some of Trump's circle were indicted. Some even went to jail. But Trump himself avoided indictment and dismissed the entire thing as a witch hunt. But Ty Cobb went on to call Robert Mueller an American hero, and Trump a threat to democracy.
And one of the presidents of a big country stood up and said, "Well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us?" I said, "You didn't pay? You're delinquent?" He said, "Yes, let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay. You got to pay your bills."
Now, once again, Donald Trump's attitude toward Vladimir Putin is in the headlines after his recent remarks about NATO and in the wake of Alexei Navalny's death in a Russian prison. Trump is also facing more than 90 criminal charges. I spoke about all of that last week with Ty Cobb. Right off the bat, because of your involvement in the Russia investigation, I have to ask you about your reaction to the death of Alexei Navalny, and maybe even more to the point, because of your own experience, Donald Trump's reaction to the death of Alexei Navalny.
You know, you don't have, sadly, in our day, people throughout history who, you know, put purpose over and principle over safety. Navalny sort of stands alone in this century, I think, so far, as the person who, you know, best and certainly most immediately projects that. I think he's as much a hero as anybody I can look back in history on and call a hero.
Joe Biden acknowledged Navalny's heroism, both when he was alive and even more forcefully after he died, and is promising more sanctions, and was pretty unambiguous about it. Donald Trump's reaction was...
Oh, no, I'm with you 100%.
Yeah, Donald Trump did not condemn Putin at all. In fact, compared Joe Biden to Putin and himself to Alexei Navalny.
He wrote this on Truth Social: "The sudden death of Alexei Navalny has made me more and more aware of what is happening in our country. It is a slow, steady progression with crooked, radical left politicians, prosecutors, and judges leading us down a path to destruction."
This Judge Arthur Engoron ruled against you for almost $500 million. It's a lot
of
dough.
It is a form of Navalny. It is a form of communism or fascism.
How did you react to that?
Whatever device people pick up to try to translate Trump, the focus needs to be analyzing everything he says through his narcissism. And he can't talk about anybody else favorably for 2 seconds without turning it, you know, to himself, comparing himself to, you know, Martin Luther King or Navalny, or, you know, he only uses heroes, historical heroes, to try to glorify himself. Shouldn't surprise anybody, because that's what he does in every circumstance. I think what surprises me is how different he speaks now than he did in 2016. He was pretty unhinged in 2016, but he at least had people like Kushner and others, you know, whispering in his ear about, you know, what was important to people. Mm-hmm. Now he doesn't have, you know, even that level of a check.
Now, I want to go back in time. You were a very respected lawyer in Washington. You get this phone call that you're going to work with Donald Trump. What was your initial reaction? Did you have any qualms about it? And why did you go forward? Did you get a sense that Donald Trump had a respect for the process, for the rule of law? Or did you get the sense that you were in a purely political realm?
So his sense was that he was in a purely political realm. You know, this was a personal attack on him, and it was set up by the FBI and perhaps others. But my own sense was this was purely legal, at least as it was, at least in Mueller's circumstances.
There's been a kind of resurrection of discussion lately, in fact, in recent days, about Donald Trump and his attitude toward Putin, his attitude toward Putin's circle, and his comments about, or lack of comments about, Navalny have revived the notion that somehow, and you see it in, with Nancy Pelosi, that somehow Russia and Putin has something on Donald Trump. How do you react to that?
So taking that predicate first, you know, there's no evidence of that. And I looked for it for a year. Shame on me if I didn't find it, if it's really there. I don't think Putin has anything on Trump. But, you know, he sort of admires the power that Putin has accumulated. And he, you know, has much the same style. In fact, I think his takeover of the RNC was very mob-like. You know, he just took it over and, you know, quite likely intends to loot it for his
daughter-in-law.
So putting her in, I think, is emblematic of the way he views it as, you know, a tool to serve himself. But I think, you know, what the end game there is being able to try to dictate who's going to be a candidate and who's going to get the financial support, and also using that financial support for his own liabilities. So I divorce the Russia investigation from anything that Trump has done with Putin. There was just nothing in the investigation, as the report reflects, frankly, that ties Trump to Putin or Putin even to the, you know, attempt to influence. And there's now, thankfully, public significant information that undercuts, you know, Brennan and Clapper, and any suggestion that Putin preferred Trump to Clinton. But in terms of Trump's affection for Putin,
as somebody who's been looking at Russia for an awfully long time and is following it, the notion that Putin preferred Trump to Clinton is pretty incontrovertible. It comes right from Putin's mouth and from various celebrations in the highest echelons of Yedinaya Russia, the United Russia Party, and all the rest. But let's debate that another time. What accounts for Donald Trump's seeming unwillingness at any point to show any critical mind toward Vladimir Putin?
In my own judgment, I think Trump's, you know, fascination with Putin is, you know, he has what Trump wants, which is total control and adulation, and riding the horse with his shirt off. Now, we're never going to see Trump with his shirt off, but...
Well, thank God for small favors.
But I do think it's really a function of his narcissism and his admiration for you know, people who, you know, have the stature within their, you know, sphere that he would like.
Why have you decided to become much blunter and about your assessment of Trump in recent times?
Because I think he certainly post January 6th has been exposed as the, you know, greatest threat to democracy that we've ever seen. And I'm a citizen, and I grew up in a little town in Kansas. My dad was a naval fighter pilot. I was the oldest of eight kids, and I've spent much of my life in public service, and I've never been one to shy away from saying what I mean.
Right now, we're looking at a Donald Trump trying to get a second term, running ahead in most of the polls.
Right.
And at the same time, he's facing over 90 felony charges across four criminal cases.
Right.
A couple of civil cases have already come to their conclusion: sexual assault and defamation, his case about his business in New York City. And that could all leave him about $400 million poorer. How do you assess this lineup of cases arrayed against Donald Trump? Which are the strongest ones? Which are the weakest? And which are the cases that are the most consequential for the election?
The only two cases that I think are consequential are the two federal cases. There's no defense in the classified documents case, particularly given the obstruction and the false affidavits related to it, and the fact that he actually shared those documents willy-nilly with, you know, visitors to Mar-a-Lago, including, you know, one of his closest advisors who's going to be a witness for the government. So I think, you know, he's dead, but he's got the protection of the judge who has basically slowed that case down to the point where there's no chance that it can get to trial before the election. The only case that can get to the get to trial before the election is the federal case in D.C. involving Trump's failure to allow the peaceful transfer of power and his attempts to obstruct that. That hinges on whether or not the Supreme Court takes certiorari on the immunity issue.
In other words, the court can agree to hear Trump's immunity argument, or they can let the lower court's ruling on immunity stand and let the case go to trial.
Right. And if they grant it, I think that dooms that case from getting to trial before the election. If they deny it, then I think it could be tried in July or late June. The problem with the New York case is not that Alvin Bragg ran on trying to get Trump. That's a political problem. That's a perception problem. But there are legal defects to the way that case was charged.
We're talking about the case involving Stormy Daniels and hush money.
Right. The misdemeanor that is charged only becomes a felony if you can tie it to an actual felony. And the felony they attempt to tie it to is a violation of the federal election laws. Now, there's a serious constitutional issue as to whether a state prosecutor can charge federal crimes. And the almost universal consensus is they can't.
Right.
So I think at the end of this...
So that's the that's the weakest of the bunch.
Right. That's very weak. And it's going to occupy, you know, a month of, you know, Trump railing against the system in New York and the judges and the prosecutors, of which I think we're all tired and familiar.
And what happens if he does win the presidency?
If he does win the presidency, he'll direct the Justice Department to dismiss both cases.
And what ensues from that? And maybe that's a political, sociological question rather than a legal one.
If Trump is convicted here, he will be out on an appeal bond. The appeal won't be heard before his inauguration, should he win. And immediately after inauguration, he'll have it dismissed, and it'll be as though the case has never existed.
And just to round things out, the Georgia case, which has its own peculiarities, to say the least.
Boy, that's for sure. You know, everybody's got different interests that they can bring to the attention of the judge in advance of trial that I think will delay that well beyond the election. The Georgia case is not something, though, Trump can dismiss. But I think the general legal consensus, which is only based on policy and not based on any statute or precedent, is that it's likely Trump would be allowed to serve his full term or serve until impeached before that case could be brought.
Right.
And at which point he'd be, you know, 83 or 4, and, you know, who knows what would happen.
Ty Cobb, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
No, I really enjoyed visiting with you. It was an honor to be with you.
Good to see you.
Take care.
Ty Cobb was special counsel to Donald Trump during the Mueller investigation, and he's an attorney in Washington, D.C. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It is that time of year again. Awards season. And we're talking about the past year in movies, of course. And longtime listeners will know that this is a very special thing for us on the show. I'm joined once again by Alexandra Schwartz, a staff writer at The New Yorker and the co-host of
Critics at Large,
a podcast you should not miss. I never do. And New Yorker film critic Richard Brody, also known as Mr. Front Row. And this is an annual tradition at The New Yorker Radio Hour, the Brody Awards. So let's first talk about that other award show, the Oscars, a petty sideshow, to be sure, to the Brodies. Yeah. But this year, there's a pretty wide sense that it's a strong year for movies, and the Oscar nominations seem to reflect that, at least up to a point. But the big scuttlebutt, and I want to hear from you guys on this, is the snubbing of Greta Gerwig for Best Director and Margot Robbie for Best Actress. What do we think happened there, Alex?
I would imagine, Richard, you may have more insight into this than I do, that there was a sense that maybe this is a big commercial comedy. I think comedies often, the direction of comedies traditionally has not been recognized to the same degree that a big, meaty drama has at the Oscars. That may be what happened to Greta Gerwig. And then Margot Robbie is Barbie Oscar material. Barbie herself, the irony of it is that this is kind of what the film addresses. You know, everyone made a big stink about the fact that Ryan Gosling, his role as Ken, was nominated. That is exactly what would happen in the Barbie-verse that the movie
exactly.
that the movie creates. It's hard to get away from a sense that everything we've been seeing around Barbie is just more promotion for Barbie. So this almost seems too perfect in a weird way.
As an offense.
Yeah, as an offense.
As a new chapter in misogyny.
Well, more that it just, again, plays into the Barbie machine to some degree. It validates the critiques that Barbie itself makes of the culture. And so there we have a new, you know, Barbie cycle.
But Richard, isn't it also part and parcel of who votes for Oscars? Even after the reforms that have come through and there's been some change, I think, in the people who vote for Oscars, isn't it still kind of old white guys still at this point?
Yes, it is, especially the director's branch. This is one of the fundamental problems that Oscar nominations face. It isn't the Academy at large that does the nominating. It's the individual branches, which I think is a terrible mistake because it essentially becomes a perpetuation of the contemporary standards of professionalism rather than inspiration and affect.
Now, the Barbenheimer phenomenon paid off not just at the box office, but at the Oscars, too. Barbie did get 8 nominations, after all, and Oppenheimer got 13 of them. And it's probably a favorite to win the big one, the Best Picture Award. Richard, I think you said the Wikipedia entry on Oppenheimer was better than the movie.
I mean, Oppenheimer is a fascinating person. The story that's told in Oppenheimer, it's not lacking in interest. Every detail is fascinating, but they seem dispersed, tossed onto the screen with no sense of the character driving them.
Richard, let's pause for 1 second. The Wikipedia entry was better than the movie?
Like, literally. Because literally, because the facts of his life are really fascinating and really complicated. He was a wild man.
I know, but this is the mean version of saying that American Prometheus, I can get if you say American Prometheus, the big biography, is better than the film, but the wiki entry?
Well, it goes in more directions. It presents a more complex character than the one who's in the movie. And that's exactly the kind of movie that the Academy likes to reward, namely a very serious, very earnest film about a grand historical subject. Barbie, by contrast, embarrasses the Academy. No matter how much money it makes, it embarrasses the Academy to be associated with a movie that some people, in my opinion, entirely wrongly assimilate to a feature-length TV commercial for a doll.
Wow. Was there a nominee that pleasantly surprised you, on the other hand, Richard? Some nominee that was egregiously irritating beyond Barbie?
The pleasant surprise was that Wes Anderson, who was shut out for Asteroid City, was at least nominated for a live-action short film, namely The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, which I highly recommend, the Roald Dahl adaptation. But there's a movie that got many nominations this year, including for Best Picture, that I find almost repugnant, namely The Zone of Interest, Jonathan Glazer's very, very loose adaptation of a novel by Martin Amis.
I have to say, I felt I had seen that movie before. In fact, many times. That whole, you know, the death camp is out of frame, ordinary life is happening. That it seemed to me not an entirely original way of going about things.
And it's done in a, am I allowed to say half-assed? It's done in a half-assed way.
Yeah. How do you mean?
Jonathan Glazer wants it both ways. He wants to make sure that you know that he knows that there's really awful stuff going on. And at the same time, he keeps his hands rigorously clean.
Let's go to an award show now that actually matters, the Brodies. We've been waiting for this for fully a year now, I think it's fair to say. Alex Schwartz is here with the official Brody envelopes. And to be clear, these nominations and awards were not chosen by any voting body. It's all one person. It's Richard Brody, and no one, including me, knows who the winners will be until they are announced right here on the air. And we're going to start with Best Actor, Alex, who was nominated.
And the nominees for the Brody Award for Best Actor are Jason Schwartzman for Asteroid City, Franz Rogowski for Passages, Adam Driver for Ferrari, Zac Efron for The Iron Claw, and Mike Faced for Pinball, the man who saved the game. And the winner is?
The winner is Franz Rogowski for Passages.
Okay.
Passages is the most international feature of the year. It's filmed in Paris by the American director Ira Sachs, starring the German actor Franz Rogowski as a German director who is married to an English man, played by Ben Whishaw, and at the end of a shoot has an affair with a woman he meets, played by the French actress Adèle Exarchopoulos. And what results is emotional turbulence of a very high order, but turbulence that does not spare the protagonist himself. He's as much buffeted by the storms of emotional chaos as the other characters.
Yeah, Richard, I've got to figure that in the Oscars, that secondary other thing, that the winner there is probably the biggest lock of the night, no?
You mean Cillian Murphy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's likely.
Yeah.
You know, biopics gratify the Academy's sense of dignity. A good actor playing an important historical figure makes the world of movies seem like it's playing on the grand stage of political history.
Let's move on to Best Actress. Alex?
The Brody nominees for Best Actress are Margot Robbie for Barbie, Tiana Taylor for 1001, Michelle Williams for Showing Up, Lily Gladstone for Killers of the Flower Moon, and Charlene McClure in All Dirt Roads, Taste of Salt. And Richard, the Brody goes to?
This was the toughest choice that I faced. The winner is Lily Gladstone for Killers of the Flower Moon.
Uh-huh.
I was sorely tempted to select Margot Robbie.
For reasons for of Bobby. Justice or? For,
because it's an extraordinary performance. Because yeah. It's one of the most virtuosic comedic performances I've seen in quite a while.
Huh.
But I find Lily Gladstone's performance in Killers of the Flower Moon to be different in kind from just about every other performance I've ever seen. In as much as it's a movie that's filled with dialogue and she handles her dialogue with great aplomb and gives it great dramatic weight. But the essence of the role is presence and silence. It's Martin Scorsese's unique conception of this story, his unique revision to David Grann's book, and she gives this remarkable conception and extraordinary dramatic power by doing as little as possible.
Well, Richard, you know, we already talked about Margot Robbie's snub. Of course, Lily Gladstone is nominated for Best Actress. I wonder what you think her shot is.
I think it's very good. Beside the representational fact that indeed no Native American actor has won an Oscar, it is an extraordinary performance, and I think that it's a performance that runs on sheer star power. And if there's one thing that the Academy is not immune to, it's star power.
Yes. Okay, so Richard, if in an ideal world where the Brody somehow melded with the Oscars themselves.
That's not an ideal world. The ideal world is one in which the Brodies displace the Oscars entirely.
That's right. In a pragmatic world where we might be able to make some strides towards
right,
integrating the Brodies into the world of the Oscars. Right. And you could make room for Margot Robbie in this category. Who would you replace? Because the Oscar nominees for Best Actress this year are Lily Gladstone. I know you would not replace her, of course. Annette Bening for Naiad. Carey Mulligan for Maestro. Emma Stone for Poor Things, and Sandra Hula for Anatomy of a Fall, a movie that we disagree on.
Anyone but Emma Stone. I find Emma Stone's performance in Poor Things striking for her handling of language. I don't find it a very satisfying drama, but Tony McNamara's script, which essentially recreates English from the perspective of an adult needing to relearn it from zero, gives Emma Stone a remarkable chance to shine with that dialogue.
Well, it's time for the big one. You know, the best director at the Oscars is largely being seen as Christopher Nolan's Race to Lose. He's up for Oppenheimer versus Martin Scorsese for Killers of the Flower Moon, Yorgos Lanthimos for Poor Things, Jonathan Glazer for The Zone of Interest, and the lone woman represented this year, Justine Triet, for Anatomy of a Fall. But who are your nominees for the best director, Brody, Richard?
Well, my nominees are Greta Gerwig for Barbie, Martin Scorsese for Killers of the Flower Moon, Kelly Reichardt for Showing Up, Raven Jackson for All Dirt Roads, Taste of Salt, and Wes Anderson for Asteroid City.
And the Brody goes to?
It goes to Wes Anderson. Although, I have to say, this was tough, too, because Martin Scorsese's direction of Killers of the Flower Moon is pretty remarkable. Just to keep a 3.5-hour-long film engaging, and I find that that time passes very rapidly, is a mark of an artistry of a different sort altogether from that of the other directors this year. But what Anderson achieves moment by moment in Asteroid City is almost unparalleled in the history of cinema. There's a level of dramatic specificity, of wit, of substance, of emotional power invested in remarkably small details that perhaps it's rivaled by, you know, Carl Theodor Dreyer or Murnau or Jacques Tati, but by very few other directors in the history of cinema.
Richard, I say this with real affection, and I'm a fan of Wes Anderson's. Do you think anybody as odd and off to the side in the view of most viewers will ever win a Best Director Oscar?
The directors who won last year were Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert for Everything Everywhere All at Once. That's a very weird movie, too. It's a sentimentally weird movie, but it's a weird movie. I don't think that the Oscars necessarily shy away from weird. I think they shy away from intellect.
The Academy, yet again, nominated a full slate of 10 movies this year for Best Picture. And some we've already talked about, Barbie, Oppenheimer, Killers of the Flower Moon. There's also The Zone of Interest, American Fiction, Maestro, The Holdovers, Anatomy of a Fall, Poor Things, and Past Lives. Richard, you want to take any parting shots at any of those movies before we give out the last Brody?
I was happy to see Past Lives get nominated from a, let's say, from an industry perspective. It's a low-budget independent film. It's not one of my favorite films of the year. Far from it, in fact. But I was nonetheless happy to see that the Academy pays attention to movies that are produced at that relatively low budget level.
Okay. Now, Alex, who were the Brody nominees for Best Picture?
Well, the moment is finally here. The nominees are Barbie, Showing Up, Killers of the Flower Moon, 1001, Earth Mama, Passages, Ferrari, Pinball, The Man Who Saved the Game, All Dirt Roads, Taste of Salt, and Asteroid City. And the Brody goes to...
It goes to Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, based on David Grann's book.
That's right, our colleague David Grann. Mazel tov to David Grann. Finally, he has a little bit of success in his literary life. He gets a Brody, or by association. Richard, you gave the Best Director Award to Wes Anderson. Usually the Best Director and the Best Picture come in one package in the Oscars. Why not here?
Well, in this particular case, a great deal depends on the writing. And although Scorsese's direction is as incisive and as imaginative as usual, I think a particular weight of this film is borne by the script. David's book is largely an investigative story centered on the Bureau of Investigation agent, the forerunner of the FBI, who attempted to discover who was killing members of the Osage Nation. And that was the story that Scorsese apparently, you know, he told me he was originally intending to film with Leonardo DiCaprio in the role of the agent, and that somewhere along the line the decision was made that, in fact, it would be not a story of the investigation, but the story of one of the perpetrators, a crucial perpetrator, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, but above all, his relationship with the Osage woman, played by Lily Gladstone, whom he was intending to kill. In effect, Martin Scorsese turned David Grann's book into a version of Eyes Wide Shut, into a movie about the almost metaphysical mysteries of marriage.
Well, it's been a big night for Martin Scorsese and Wes Anderson and many others. Alex Schwartz, Richard Brody, it's always a pleasure. You can find Richard Brody's column on film, The Front Row. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
David, Alex, thank you.
We'll continue soon with one of Richard Brody's award winners, Lily Gladstone, star of Killers of the Flower Moon. That's all in a moment on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
I kind of felt like if I had gone to L.A. or New York and done like the classic, you know, just audition endlessly, hold down another job to support yourself, you know, get an agent, get out there as much as possible. Just thinking about it was starting to kill my passion for it a little.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition.
Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Lily Gladstone has been in over a dozen films, including Kelly Reichardt's Certain Women. And she's been on Reservation Dogs, created by Sterling Harjo. But making a life as an actor, it's just not an easy thing. And Gladstone said she was applying for seasonal work at the Department of Agriculture studying insects when she heard from a certain Martin Scorsese. Scorsese eventually cast her as a lead in Killers of the Flower Moon. The film concerns a grisly series of murders that took place in the Osage Nation after oil was discovered there. Gladstone plays Molly Burkhart, an Osage woman married to a white man named Ernest, played in the film by Leonardo DiCaprio. Gladstone is nominated for the Academy Award for Best Actress, and that's a historic first for a Native woman. She spoke recently with Michael Shulman, a staff writer at The New Yorker.
Your high school yearbook from Mount Lake Terrace High School has made the rounds online, so I know that you were voted most likely to win an Oscar. There's no question that's true.
It's really sweet. My graduating class and then a lot of people that were in the same drama program, they're reuniting to watch the Oscars in our old high school theater. It's really touching.
Well, so then you went and studied acting and directing at the University of Montana. I'm curious, when you got out, what your early career was like. What kind of roles were you auditioning for? What were you getting? And what kind of day jobs were you doing for survival?
I decided to stay in Montana instead of going to LA or New York like a lot of my graduating class did, because I kind of felt like if I had gone to LA or New York and done like the classic, you know, just audition endlessly, hold down another job to support yourself, you know, get an agent, get out there as much as possible. Just thinking about it was starting to kill my passion for it a little. So I stayed in Montana, where I had built some connections with some local filmmakers that I really liked. In between the theater tours, I auditioned for a one-woman show that toured into schools teaching about Native American boarding school experience. So it was like a teacher-actor position that I had for a number of years.
I read about this. This was like you were acting against a recorded track in auditoriums. Can you tell me what that was?
Yeah, it's a Seattle-based company called Living Voices, and I was performing a show that was teaching about Native American boarding school experience, and with historical documents projected through like behind you on the screen, and pre-recorded voices from other actors that etch out this period in history. The character I played was Dene, and she was a boarding school survivor who had gone through the Ganado Mission Hospital and trained to become a nurse, and to become a nurse in World War II, and then was kind of in a letter correspondence with her her clan brother, who had become a Navajo code talker. So I was teaching a little bit about that history as well. So I did that for as many years as I could in my 20s, but kind of got burned out on it because, you know, it's also a heavy task to walk in with, you know, this one specific curriculum, but finding that you have to do so much just 101 before you even start the show, you know, contextualizing that there's 574 different tribal nations in the United States. And, you know, we all look different ways now, and we all come from different backgrounds, and we have a lot of different languages. And yes, we're still here, and no, we don't still live in teepees. You know, a lot of us still have them, but like, you know, but not every Native nation had lodges, you know, just little things like that.
Right. And little then there's like a sophomore sleeping in the first row or something.
Oh, yeah.
Teens are a tough audience.
Teens are the toughest audience. I kind of found, I know teachers at the middle school level get burned out, but I've found that middle schoolers are kind of the best audience for that kind of thing. Mm. They're still young enough to really enjoy the theater of it and to like buy into the magical realism, suspension of disbelief, but they're also sophisticated enough to like grasp concepts of, yes, the assimilation policy was really bad for Native people. Yeah, that was, it was really rewarding, but incredibly exhausting work, as any teacher will attest. So that job kept me going, supplementing between cashiering at Staples and then every once in a while having an independent film that I would get to go do. But the assumption that I've also found as a Native actor is there's a lot of roles that I've played now that's required that I speak another Indigenous language. And I'm by no means even fluent in Blackfeet. You know, I can introduce myself. I have a few words and phrases. I know some of the bad words, but
can you please curse in Blackfeet right now? I want to hear.
I'm just going to drop this from my Blackfeet folks, but I'm not going to say what it means. Siksimisi, one of the worst things and funniest things you can say about somebody. And, you know, right. it's a fairly PG thing, but you know, it's my favorite word in our language. So. I think that's an aspect of Native performance that I think a lot of people take for granted, is how hard it is. You know, we celebrate other actors for picking up other, like, European languages for a role, for scenes, and sounding proficient and fluent. But for some reason, that same awe and that same credit is often just kind of dismissed for Native actors, because people assume, oh, that you all speak that. It's like, no, it's a huge gift to be able to speak an Indigenous language.
I want to move on to Kill to the Flower Moon and your character, Molly. The movie is based on the book by our colleague here at The New Yorker, David Gran. When you were figuring out how to play Molly, you know, she was a real person who made real choices and lived through very extreme circumstances. What was most familiar about her, and what was most enigmatic or obscure to you?
In reading the book, particularly, I got a sense of the kind of person that I was recognized or that I would recognize in my own community, the kind of like, you know, women I recognized from my grandma's side of the family, my Nez Perce side. What was really exciting was the idea of having a chance to kind of break some stereotypes with her as well in her relationship with her sisters. Because relationship that like Native women have with each other, especially our families, it's like we're very like, you know, we love being together. We love joking. We love gossiping and teasing. And, you know, I could really see that with like my grandma's sisters, the way that they were together, being very proper still, but just giggling about everything. And that's like not the Native woman that you're used to seeing in cinema. It's like you're used to seeing more like a stoic, like kind of mean, whatever. And it's like, well, it's because there's outsiders around, you know, people are a little bit more guarded. Yeah. You know, like I said, I didn't want to overextend like my own cultural understanding into Molly as an Osage woman, but it was a basis. A lot of the familiarity I felt with her that reminded me of stories I'd heard about my great grandma Lily, who I never met. She passed before I was born. I could hear echoed. I could see maybe where Gran had gotten his illustration, the way that he was able to sketch Molly, the way that he drew her personality. I could feel that.
And Molly has a very strange and conflicted relationship with her husband, Ernest, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. I want to zero in on my favorite scene in the film, a scene that's up there with the all-time great Martin Scorsese scenes, which is their first date when she invites him to dinner at her house and they're flirting, they're smoking, and she kind of calls him out as a coyote and says, coyote wants money.
Yeah.
And then offers him whiskey.
Echo.
Coyote.
Coyote wants money.
Well, that money's real nice. It's real nice. Especially if you're lazy like me. I mean, I want to sleep all day. I don't want to make a party when it's dark. What's so funny?
You like Bethany?
Whiskey. I don't like whiskey. I love whiskey.
I have good whiskey. Not bad whiskey.
I think we should try some and find out.
Ish.
Molly is doing a lot in that scene. It's, you know, she's trying to figure this guy out, and in a way she has, but in a way she hasn't, because of course he's plotting to, you know, marry into her family and take her oil money.
Right. And at that point, like, you know, people were starting to pass away. And it was a really difficult transitional time for Osage. And this is also a generation, kind of like the first and second generation that had gone through boarding schools. So Molly and her sisters being boarding school survivors as well. So there's a whole lot of contextualized history behind that. And a lot of that also came from Charles Redcorn's book, A Pipe for February, which talks about this period of time. It's a novel that writes about the Osage Reign of Terror from an Osage perspective. And kind of how, like, the slow rise in, you know, as people are dying, the rise in paranoia was kind of slow. Because there's a lot of things that community would attribute these deaths to that were related to historical trauma. It wasn't immediately obvious that people were being poisoned to death, you know. And, you know, like you see, like, these new folks coming in, that initial wave is like, oh, these guys are new. And it's like, there's a flirtation that happens. There's an exoticism that's happening on both sides. So me and the sisters definitely etched that out in that scene where we're gossiping about the men.
Right, what do you think that she sees in Ernest?
You know, it's a dynamic that I'm very used to seeing, even in my own family. It's kind of a sustaining one, and I think you can find it in a lot of relationships. Just this kind of fun-loving, larger-than-life, you know, inappropriate sometimes, goofy cowboy of a guy with this very self-possessed, like, humble, acting on protocol native woman that he just lives to crack her shell and make her laugh, and like how much joy she gets from that too. So just kind of that back and forth, you know. That scene underwent a couple of different changes, and you pointed to it, the trickster element of it. It's not going to be explicitly clear to the audience when Molly calls him Shomikas, he calls him Coyote. She's not just calling him the animal, she's calling him a trickster. Because one of the trickster figures in oral tradition with Osage is Coyote. And there's several of them, but Coyote's like the fop, is the one that's always tripping over his own feet, acting very hedonistically in self-interest, and he never really wins. You know, he'll screw up everything for everybody involved in the story in a very funny way, especially when you're telling it to kids. But in the end, he just never wins. When I was learning these stories, a lot of them reminded me of our trickster stories, Blackfeet stories. Even though the structure's different, the landscape's different, like kind of the progression of the stories and the humor of them felt very familiar. And it gave Ernest a place to hide.
You know, it's funny. Some of the movies that it called to mind for me are actually these kind of domestic dramas, like Gaslight with Ingrid Bergman, and Suspicion with Joan Fontaine and Cary Grant. These stories of women who are married to men who they slowly realize are terrorizing them. And of course, that gets more acute as the film goes on. And you know, she is starting to realize that he's not only responsible for the deaths of her family members, but is actively poisoning her through her insulin. And for the audience, you reach a point where you kind of want to scream at her to wake up and just run away from the guy. And yet she doesn't do that. And you start to wonder how much is she seeing right through him when he's lying to her face? How much is she deluding herself? I'm curious, was that the question for you as the story goes on?
Well, where I found a place that Molly would have had a huge blind spot in all of that, I mean, one, it's like what you suspect in your subconscious mind we've gotten conditioned to dismissing if, what's right in front of us doesn't check out. You know, he's so good with the kids and he just doesn't seem capable of it. But one of the biggest clues for me, especially during that period of time where Molly's getting the insulin, the family has pretty much surmised she was also getting a combination of arsenic and morphine. So there was the delivery process, having a long time ago played a morphine addict in my first play and doing the research about that, the chemical dependency on that, how the immediate relief of everything, that was a clue to me that, okay, Ernest is the delivery mechanism. So while her subconscious and conscious mind are dancing with each other so much, while her body is being eroded by arsenic, but also healed by insulin, and she's addicted to the whole process, the only thing that she sees consistently is Ernest that's bringing this to her, that's bringing her this relief. So when she does have a sober mind later, unknowingly, that's how I approach those end scenes as well. It's just people in my life I've been close to who are recovering addicts and who are leaving toxic, abusive, codependent relationships with, you know, be it with people or be it with substance. That was a big clue to me that, you know, gave me some compassion for what Molly wasn't seeing, what she was incapable of seeing, and even if she was seeing and suspecting it, incapable of leaving, literally.
I am a studier of Oscar history, and I know that in the past, it's been a real mixed experience for people who have been the first in their category. One story, Sidney Poitier, of course, was the first Black man to win Best Actor in 1964, and not after he won for Lilies of the Field. He was being honored at the mayor's office in New York City, and the reporters kept asking him about civil rights, and he finally snapped. He was not a person who generally snapped, and said, "Why is it everything you guys ask refers to the negroness of my life and not my acting?" I'm curious if you have felt that sort of tension of being out here as an actor, but also as, you know, the face of a community. And in addition to that, you're playing an Osage woman, so it's not even quite your community.
One thing that I've really appreciated is I'm friends with Sterling Harjo, the creator of Reservation Dogs. And, you know, we're both in the circuit right now for both of these projects. And so when we were catching up and just visiting about kind of this shared space we're finding ourselves navigating, he put it really well. He said, we're in a position where we've, like, you know, we're kicking the door in. but kind of the reality of what that is and maybe what it has to be, when you kick the door in, you should just kind of put your foot in the door and stand there, you know? It's like kicking the door in and running through it means it's going to shut behind you. So it's really nice to, you know, remember that while I'm the first specifically Native American indigenous woman, there has been other representation. I stand on the shoulders of a lot of performers, and like, it's circumstantial. This point in history, the film that I'm in, the performance that I was blessed enough to be able to carry, it's still, it feels like a very shared moment, and it feels like a big responsibility to just be and to, you know, celebrate others and to keep pushing for more representation. So I'm just kind of, if I've kicked the door in, I'm just trying to stand here and leave it open for everybody else to come through.
Well, I will be looking forward to it, and also looking forward to the rest of this crazy award season. Congratulations again, and it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Lily Gladstone won a Golden Globe for her performance in Killers of the Flower Moon, and she's up for an Oscar in March. You can read Michael Shulman at NewYorker.com, and he's the author of Oscar Wars: A History of Hollywood in Gold, Sweat, and Tears. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining us, and see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett.
And we had additional help this week from Ramel Wood.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.